Hare Krishna. Okay, so welcome to the first of about five sessions on a seminar that I'm presenting called Srila Prabhupada, the Living Bhagavatam. This is, I think up until Friday night will be the last session. What's today, Wednesday? Yeah. Tuesday? Alright, I just got in this morning. I'm still somewhere over the Atlantic at the moment. Okay, today's Tuesday. I think Wednesday, Thursday, and possibly Friday. We'll be giving a series of classes. And the topic, of course, is Srila Prabhupada's transcendental activities. I was fortunate enough to be able to travel with Prabhupada from November 75 up until the end of March 1977. And during that period, I was keeping a diary, keeping a record of what was happening. And of course, we were also recording everything on tape recorder. So in the last few years, I've been working on this series, the Transcendental Diary. This is the fifth volume. It's the latest of the volumes. There'll be two more after that one. That will take it up to seven. And that covers that whole period on a day-by-day basis. It's a chronological account. But there's also another presentation that I've been making the last couple of years, and that's by theme. So instead of just doing, you know, day-by-day, I thought it would be nice to examine what Prabhupada said and did in reference to particular topics of or items of devotional service. So, you know, prasadam, or chanting, or health, or writing books, distributing books, etc. There's about seven or eight different topics, and I've just compiled everything that I could find from the period that I was with Prabhupada on that particular topic. And by going through it, it gives a more concentrated look, you know, at that particular aspect of devotional life. And it shows how Srila Prabhupada was applying himself and how he expected others to apply themselves in that particular area of devotional service. So you get a lot of different angles of vision on a particular topic. So therefore I decided to call this the Living Bhagavatam, because of course in the Srimad Bhagavatam, it's mentioned there also that there's two kinds of Bhagavat. There's the book Bhagavat and there's the person Bhagavat, and both of them we have to serve. And if we see the example, practical example of our pure devotees living according to the Bhagavatam, then that gives us a very immediate and direct understanding about devotional service and how we should live our lives as devotees. Otherwise, you know, things tend to be a little bit intellectual. You read books, but there's a lot, you know. There's so many volumes of Bhagavatam, there's so many volumes of Chaitanya Charitamrita, Nectar of Devotion, Nectar of Instruction. There's a huge amount of literature. And as Prabhupada said, if you actually carefully studied them, it would take your lifetimes to get through. But when you see a pure devotee in action, then immediately it's all there before you. And if you just, you know, observe closely enough, then you'll learn practically what it means to be a devotee, what it means to be Krishna conscious. So it's a very direct way and it has a lot of impact. And therefore it's very important for us to study the lives of pure devotees. And in particular it's very important for us to understand and study the life of Srila Prabhupada, because he's the one who introduced us to Krishna consciousness in the context that we're living now. Yeah, it's not very far removed. This is only 30 years ago that we're talking here. And, of course, Prabhupada was specifically empowered by Lord Chaitanya, how to spread his movement to every culture and every language, or through every language, all over the world, and how to inject pure devotional service into the midst of so much diversity, you know, of culture and language and social conditions, and raise people up to the transcendental level. That's not an ordinary feat. Yeah. It's not an ordinary thing, even for the Vaishnava, for a pure devotee, to be able to do that. So Prabhupada was a very exceptional personality. That's why he's called the founder Acharya, rather than just an Acharya. He founded, you know, an international society, and there's never been one of those before, at least in Vaishnava terms. So this is our bedrock, this is what we build our devotional service upon, is the example that Prabhupada gave us, yeah, his practice and precept. So at least I hope that this seminar will convey a little something of Prabhupada's practical example in devotional service. So as I mentioned, I joined Prabhupada's party in late 1975. Prabhupada had come to New Delhi on the 25th of November, and he was in a kind of a unusual situation in that he had no secretary and he had no servant with him. Prabhupada used to travel with generally at least two or three people. One was his regular secretary, one was his servant to look after his personal needs. The secretary would look after all the travel arrangements and managing all the appointments and things, taking care of Prabhupada's correspondence, that kind of thing. The servant would look after Prabhupada's personal needs, give him two massages every day, and generally also cook. And then sometimes also there was Pradyumna Prabhu, or at one point there was a devotee called Nitai Das, and they were Prabhupada's Sanskrit editor, so that as he was traveling, because Prabhupada was writing his books in the night time, and so whatever he dictated on the dictaphone, then that was transcribed the next day, and the Sanskrit editor would go through that. And then once it had been edited, it was sent to Los Angeles to the BBT, and then the composition was done there, and then they would produce the book from that. So generally there was at least two, servant and secretary. When Prabhupada came up to Delhi though, because of some problems that had been arisen in our yatra in Africa, Prabhupada had just been down to South Africa, and then he came up to Nairobi, and then he went to Mauritius. So there were a lot of problems in the African yatra. And Prabhupada's secretary at that time, in most of 1975, that was Brahmananda Swami. But Brahmananda was also the GBC. He was the head guy in charge in Africa. And when they actually went there, in October of 75, then it became apparent that there were a lot of problems. So when Prabhupada arrived back in Bombay in November, then he sent Brahmananda straight back to Africa, and with him he sent his personal servant also, who had been Navi Yogendra at that time. He gave him sannyas, and there was another devotee who had once been Prabhupada's personal servant. That was Nanda Kumar. Nanda Kumar was kind of in and out of devotional life. He was very unsteady. So he had turned up in November 75 in Bombay. He came to see Prabhupada, and he was doing some business selling, you know, Ayurvedic medicine and herbs, because Prabhupada had been informed that he was selling some herbs that he shouldn't have been selling. So when he went to see Prabhupada, then Prabhupada asked him, what are you doing? And he said, I'm selling, you know, this Ayurvedic medicine and things. then Prabhupada said, if you do this business, you'll go to hell. So then Nanda was shocked, and he said, well, Prabhupada, what shall I do? So then Prabhupada said, take sannyas. So to try to save him, actually. He gave him sannyas with Navayogendra, and he sent the two of them with Brahmananda to Africa. Then he came up to Delhi. Now Prabhupada came to Delhi with the intention of going up to Kurukshetra. He had met previously with a man called Gulzarilal Nanda. Nanda was one of the original politicians in the government, the first independent government of India. So he was a big guy. He had stood in as the president of India, and I think he'd stood in as the prime minister of India when Shastri had died in 63. Then he was the acting prime minister until they got a new one in Indira Gandhi. And so you know, he was an important man, but he'd retired by 1975. But what he was doing was he was developing Kurukshetra. There was a big project there. He'd gotten a very big grant from the government, and they were redeveloping all the pilgrim facility there. If you've ever been to Kurukshetra, it's about 3 hours north of Delhi, and there's one very big lake. It's about 2/3 of a mile long and about 1/3 of a mile wide. That's called Brahma Sarova, and that's the main bathing area when you go to Kurukshetra. So now if you go, you'll see all the entire bank all the way around is all very nicely paved with sandstone steps and some proper bathing areas for the ladies and things like that. So Nanda was working on that at that time. He was the guy in charge. And Srila Prabhupada's interest was that he wanted to open a Varnashram college in Kurukshetra. So to that end, Ambarish Prabhu, otherwise known as Alfred Brush Ford, great-grandson of Henry Ford, he gave Prabhupada $150,000 so that he could begin this Varnashram college. And he had flown into Nairobi and then came with Prabhupada to India and then up to Delhi. So he wasn't on the party, but he was just kind of accompanying Prabhupada. So when Prabhupada came up to Delhi, it was minus his servant and secretary. He had one man with him, that was Harikesh. And Harikesh was cooking and was transcribing his tapes. So he was on the party, but he actually wasn't doing, you know, he was doing some of the servant's duties, but not all of them, and in particular not the massage. So Prabhupada arrived on the 25th. Then there were two devotees in Vrindavan that came to see him. One of them was Nittai Das, the other was Upendra Das. They had also both been Prabhupada's personal servants. And in fact, Prabhupada had come to Vrindavan at Janmashtami of 75, which was like August time. And he had stayed for 3 weeks up until Radhashtami. And Upendra and Nittai were on the party at that point. But when Prabhupada left Vrindavan to go to South Africa, those two dropped off the party and stayed in Vrindavan. Upendra stayed because he was waiting for a ticket to go to Fiji, and he was going to go and preach there. And Nittai dropped off because he wanted to help with the development of the Gurukul in the Vrindavan temple. So a couple of months later, they were still both there. But Upendra had just got his ticket after two or three months waiting. And he was due to fly out on the 27th of November to Fiji. Nittai was there, but he had to immediately go down to Bombay because his visa was running out. So the two of them came in on the 25th. They saw Prabhupada. Upendra immediately did Prabhupada's massage that day and the next day, but was leaving the following day. And Nittai couldn't even stay one day. He had to go straight to Bombay. So, in other words, there had been four personal servants in India at that point, but somehow or another, none of them were available. And then I had been in the Vrindavan temple. I was the temple commander at that time. and I had to go into Delhi on the 25th on some personal business. So I was just going to go in for the day and then go back to the Vrindavan temple, because we'd embarked on a thorough clean, cleansing of the temple. 75 was when all the volumes of the Chaitanya Charitamrita had just come out. And so we were reading about all these wonderful pastimes. And we got this volume from Brahmananda, as it was actually, describing the cleaning of the Gundicha temple and then the Rathayatra festival in Puri. So of course that was very inspiring. So we got this idea, now Prabhupada's going to come back. He was due to return in December. So we thought we'll give the temple its first big clean. So I was engaged in doing that. We were washing from the ceiling down to the floor. And we'd practically done the whole temple. And then Prabhupada arrived in Delhi. So, and then I had to go in for this one day. So I got to Delhi. And then as soon as I arrived there, the GBC, Gopal Krishna, he immediately asked me, you know, we need somebody to stand as Prabhupada's door guard. Because in those days, the Delhi temple, it was a very, very tiny place. Not much bigger, actually, than just this temple room. There was a couple of little outhouses. And it was a kind of a very run-down building. The facility was very poor. It was in a good location, Bengali Markets, which is a small commercial center just off Connaught Place. But our facility was really not adequate. And it was a very temporary rental as well. So Prabhupada wasn't staying at the temple. The temple was at number 19 Todamol Lane. But Prabhupada was staying in a small flat at number 9. So Gopal thought it would be good to have somebody sitting at the door as a door guard. Anyway, I didn't think that it was particularly, you know, a necessary service. But I was very happy to, you know, kind of... to accept it and do it, because I thought at least if I sit at the door I'll see Srila Prabhupada and you know, you can get in for darshan and like that. Because in those days it wasn't that easy to see Prabhupada, at least not close up. We used to see him on the Vyasasan, and if you were really lucky, if Prabhupada came to the temple that you were staying or near there, you might get out on one morning walk or something with it, if you were chosen. And that was it. You know, it was a very kind of formal thing. But, you know, you couldn't, it was very difficult to get into Prabhupada's room. In India it was a little easier. The darshans were very open and, you know, you could kind of go in and out. But in the Western temple, and I had joined in Australia in 72, so we used to see Prabhupada once a year. He would come for 1 week, and, you know, that's all you got for the whole year. So it was a little unusual to get this opportunity, you know, to kind of sit in Prabhupada's doorway there and actually see him during the daytime coming and going. So I jumped at the chance to do that. Then the next day I was in the temple room chanting my rounds about noon. And Harikesh suddenly stuck his head through the door and, you know, kind of gave me this very intense look. And then he said, can you do massage? So then I said, no, I've never done it in my whole life. So he said, well, Upendra's leaving tomorrow and we don't have anybody to massage Srila Prabhupada, so you're going to have to do it. So I was, you know, stunned, actually. I actually couldn't believe it. And then he said, you know, Prabhupada's up on the roof right now. Upendra's massaging him, so go up and see how he's doing it. So that I, you know, I couldn't believe it, but at the same time I wasn't going to hang about and dispute or, you know, debate it. I ran down the road, I ran up the steps, came on the roof, and sure enough there was Srila Prabhupada. And Upendra was massaging him. Prabhupada had his eyes closed. Prabhupada used to take his massage sitting up. He didn't. In the evening he would take another massage lying down. But the main massage was at noon. and that was a full body massage with two kinds of oil, and he would always be sitting up. So he was sitting, but his eyes were closed. I offered my obeisances and then just sat there. And then after a minute, Prabhupada opened his eyes, and he looked at me and said, yes. And the way he said it was, it kind of made a doubt in my mind, you know, maybe I'd misunderstood what Harikesh had said, you know, was I really supposed to be here or not? I mean, I really didn't believe it until I actually got up on the roof there and saw that Prabhupada was sitting there. You know, then I started to realize this is actually happening. And so I said, well, you know, Harikesh said to come up and see how to do your massage because Upendra is leaving tomorrow. Prabhupada just tipped his head. He said, all right, and closed his eyes again, and that was it. So, you know, I sat there for an hour. And then Prabhupada went down to take his bath. And Upendra took literally 2 minutes to show me how to do the massage. He just kind of explained what order to do Prabhupada's body in and which oils to use. Sandalwood for the head and mustard for the rest of his body. And that was it. That was my training. And then, you know, I was kind of kicked out and told to come back at 9 o'clock in the evening. Because I was there for the afternoon darshan. But then I had to report back at 9. And at that point, I didn't even know Prabhupada had an evening massage. It was news to me. I'd been in the movement about 3.5 years at that point. So I came back at 9 and went into Prabhupada's room. That was also a completely brand new experience, just seeing Srila Prabhupada in his rooms in the evening, just his servants were there. It's kind of very relaxed. He'd just been taking some prasadam. And, you know, the atmosphere was very informal. Kind of casual. And it was just a whole different mode that I'd ever seen Prabhupada in. Interestingly, actually, I mean, a lot of us had that kind of, you know, awe and reverence. That's natural. You have to have the attitude of awe and reverence for the spiritual master. But with Prabhupada particularly, because he had about 4,500 disciples at that point, and, you know, the rarity of even seeing him in person, and then, even then, you only saw him on the Vyasasan. So then to be in his rooms and just, you know, in this kind of relaxed atmosphere was a whole different world. I remember in 1982, I had become the GBC in New York. So I was reading my diary, you know, for the pleasure of the devotees. And one of the senior devotees, he came to me afterwards, and he said, you know, when you're reading your diary, it really disturbs me. And I was surprised. I was thinking, you know, I'd be really happy to hear about, you know, Prabhupada's activities. So I said, why? He said, well, he said, my only view of Srila Prabhupada as just being seeing him on the Vyasasan. You know, that's the way I've seen Prabhupada. And to hear about all these, you know, more intimate activities. So I don't know how to deal with that. You know. So I mean, you know, that mood was there for most of us. And similarly for me, when inside his room at 9 o'clock at night, it was just a completely different experience. Anyway, then Prabhupada retired. We went in Prabhupada's bedroom, I followed the Pandur in, and then he showed me how to do the evening massage. And that took about 10 minutes. That was it. Prabhupada laid down on the bed, lights were out, he was fully clothed, and it was just a dry massage, and just from the hips down. Because Prabhupada used to spend most of his day just sitting down and meeting people. So he would sometimes get a bit of numbness. And that massage was just to help with the blood circulation and just keep his muscles and joints flexible. So on average, later on, it kind of usually took about half an hour or 45 minutes. But at that first evening, it was 10 minutes and that was finished. Then I was told to go out. So that was my introduction to Prabhupada's personal service. I was supposed to only do that massage service, and then only for about 2 to 3 days. And Harikesh had made an arrangement that when Prabhupada went to Vrindavan, then this other devotee, a French devotee, Prituputra, he would become Prabhupada's masseur. And then when Prabhupada went down to Bombay after that period in Vrindavan, then Nittai Das would again come back on the party. So I was, you know, it was a temporary thing, 3 or 4 days. Prabhupada was waiting for this man, Gulzarilal Nanda, to come and make an arrangement for him to go to Kurukshetra so that he could see the land there and see if he wanted to buy some land for this Varnashram college that he was going to build with Ambarish. So anyway, that first night when I came out of Prabhupada's room, I just thought, this is so extraordinary. You know, you just don't get a chance to personally serve a personality like Srila Prabhupada for lifetimes. You know, what to speak about this lifetime, many lifetimes, you probably wouldn't meet somebody like Prabhupada and get that kind of opportunity. So I ran down the road, there was a small bookstore on the corner, the new janitor bookstore, and I bought a notebook, and I thought, I'll write, you know, what happens down, and then in 10 or 20 years' time, then I can look back, I'll read that, and I'll remember, you know, this opportunity and Prabhupada's activities. So I started keeping a diary. Anyway, as things turned out, I got added to the party on a more permanent basis. That's another story which I won't relate now, but I ended up being Prabhupada's servant for 16 months without a break. So that went through till March of 1977. So once I started this diary, I just kept it up. Later on, I actually, after a few months, I understood this is not just for me, this is actually for all the devotees, because, you know, this is history. Prabhupada's activities are going to be recorded as a historical event, and I'm here, you know, so I should keep notes of that. In 1977, when I did leave Prabhupada's party, he sent me back to Australia as the GBC there. The new secretary who had just come on was Tamal Krishna Goswami, and he was made Prabhupada's permanent secretary at the GBC meetings in 1977 in Mayapur. And the day I left, I went into Tamal's room and I said, you know, Maharaj, I've been keeping this diary. Now I'm leaving. Now who's going to continue with this? It's very important. It has to be done. So I said, you have to keep a diary. So then he was saying, oh, you know, I'm really busy. I won't be able to do this. I've got too much to do. Prabhupada at that time was also very sick. So, you know, there was a lot of demands on the personal servants and secretary, looking after him. So I said, you know, I can't do this. So I said, look, you've got to do this. It's really important. I said, if you look back, how many servants and secretaries there have been, but what do we know about Prabhupada's life? There's so many things that have happened, you know, which we don't know anything about. And in those days, there was no Prabhupada Lilamrita. There was no biography. We knew a very short version of Prabhupada's biography. But day to day, nobody knew anything about what Prabhupada was doing practically, except the servants and secretaries. And if they didn't write it down, then it was lost. So I said, you know, you've got to do this. You have to keep this as a record. So I said, oh, well, I'll think about it. So that was it. Then, fortunately, later on, in April, Tamal Krishna Maharaj did start keeping a diary. And we have that, of course, that's TKG's diary. And that goes up until the end of Prabhupada's Manifest Pastimes, November of 77. So, more or less, then, with my diary and Tamal's diary, we have at least a detailed presentation of Prabhupada's activities on a daily basis last couple of years. So 1978, actually, just after Prabhupada's disappearance, I was with Tamal Krishna Maharaj in Vrindavan, and he asked me one day, he said, what are you going to do with your diary? So I said, I'm going to publish it, because, you know, I think that the opportunity that I had to be with Srila Prabhupada should be shared with as many of his disciples as possible. I don't, you know, think it's an exclusive thing, you know, that just me and a few others should have that experience. I think all the devotees, they're all disciples of Prabhupada, and they should have the chance to have the same experience, at least as much as we can give it. So then I asked him, what are you going to do with your diary? And he said, I'm not going to publish it. So I said, why? So I said, no, there's some things in there that are private and, you know, they shouldn't be made, you know, available in general, in public. So I said, well, okay, you know, you can edit it or whatever, but, you know, you have to share, you know, the experiences with all the rest of the devotees. So then he laughed. He said, okay. He said, well, even if I do, he said, I won't do it until after you've finished yours. So I'm still trying to finish mine, actually, 30 years on. But fortunately, Tamal Krishna Maharaj did publish his diary in about 1998. I had 4 volumes of mine out by that time. But I haven't finished it yet. I'm still working on it. But he got his out. So we're lucky that he did that, because, of course, he also left us in 2002. And if he hadn't published when he did, we would have lost that. So anyway, we're very fortunate. We have a chance at least to see the life and times of a pure devotee. We have a chance to understand what it means to live the Bhagavatam. The Bhagavatam, of course, is our main source of information, what it means to be a God-conscious person, a Krishna-conscious person. And we have, you know, a unique opportunity in history practically. If you look back, because we've got the Chaitanya Charitamrita, which is the biography of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, but we really don't have a lot of information, as much as what we would like. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, Prabhupada's guru, he comments that actually originally there were hundreds of biographies of Lord Chaitanya, but in the passage of time, almost all of them have been lost. So we have the Chaitanya Bhagavat, we have Chaitanya Charitamrita. Because that in itself is, you know, it's sufficient, but it would be nice if these other biographies were available. And Srila Bhaktisiddhanta laments that it's a great loss to the world. So anyway, we're lucky because, you know, we're living in an age where you can publish information and it can go all over the world in a second. Yeah, when Rupa Goswami and Jiva Goswami and the others were writing, they were writing on leaf, you know, palm leaves by hand. One copy. And if somebody wanted a copy, they had to sit down and write it out by hand. That's how things were transmitted. No printing presses. Yeah, just everything handwritten. So you see how difficult it was to disseminate information. Now we're in a very unique situation, you know, with the, especially now, even in Prabhupada's time there was no internet, but now we have, you know, an opportunity, we can just put stuff out, millions of people can access it simultaneously. And Prabhupada was very, you know, diligent in taking advantage of whatever technology was available. You see that as soon as he got to America, he immediately got a dictaphone, tape recorder. And before practically he started doing his public preaching, he sat down and he, you know, started dictating things onto a tape recorder. So Prabhupada was always, you know, thinking in advance, taking advantage of the opportunities that were there for him. And he printed ultimately millions and millions of books. By the time of Prabhupada's disappearance, there was probably about 6 or 7 million books being distributed around the world every year. So anyway, as I say, we've got a chance to look very closely at Prabhupada's activities and learn from that, and I think, you know, we can all get a lot of profit from understanding how Prabhupada was, you know, living the Bhagavatam. So that was it was a realization that I got very early on when I joined Prabhupada's party. I had 2-3 days in Delhi, and then we went to Kurukshetra for one day. And then on December the 2nd, Prabhupada came from Delhi to Vrindavan, and he was there for about 10 days. So it was at that point that I was added on as a, you know, kind of regular servant. I was given more than just the massage to do as my duties. So I moved right into Prabhupada's quarters, and you know, then I got a chance to see him 24 hours, you know, every day. And I had a, you know, quite a few realizations. So one of them really, really struck me very strongly. I recorded that down. So this is on December the 2nd, 1975, in Vrindavan. It's extremely pleasurable to be with Srila Prabhupada during these quiet moments. He is gentle and mild in his manner, and completely fixed and steady in his devotion to Krishna. He has tremendous strength and force, but is devoid of passion. His presence is totally dominating, without being at all domineering. And his mind is steady and his senses controlled effortlessly. His intelligence is perfectly clear, and he knows how to act and how others should act in every situation. His presence thus makes spiritual life a reality. Watching him today, it struck me that he is a living, breathing Bhagavatam. Whatever description of Krishna consciousness is in his books, he himself is that. Reading his books brings gradual realization, but what is understood in perhaps several lifetimes of study is revealed on a second-to-second, minute-to-minute, and day-to-day basis in Srila Prabhupada's presence. I've therefore resolved within myself to learn as much as I can while I have this matchless opportunity to observe him closely. Simply watching Prabhupada in his daily activities, how he deals with the devotees, how he responds to different situations, how he preaches, how he manages the worldwide affairs of his international society, how he relaxes, how he continually pushes forward the movement of Lord Chaitanya, and how absolutely every facet of his being is fully Krishna conscious. It is quite feasible then to understand the full import of the sacred scriptures. By studying and preaching, one may make steady advancement. But at least for me, although I have full faith in Krishna consciousness, many ideas and principles are still only intellectually perceived, but not yet fully realized. But by observing Srila Prabhupada, I can see that they are a natural, integral part of his very being. So it was just a very strong realization that I had, that if I just sit and look, just observe Prabhupada, then I'll understand what Krishna consciousness is. You know, you can read so many things, but when you see it there before you, that's, you know, it becomes real. Otherwise, it's just kind of, you get the idea in your head, but there's so many other conditioning and, you know, social conditions and things that you have to struggle with. But with Prabhupada, it was all there, right in front of your very eyes. So Prabhupada also himself mentioned this principle, the importance of the living Bhagavatam. That was on August the 5th, 1976. I'd been with Prabhupada about 7 months at that time. Prabhupada had gone, he was here in England the last week of July. Then we went to France, and we went to our country project there, New Mayapur, the big chateau. There's about 200 acres of land. And just at that time, when Prabhupada came here to London, then he was given the first volume of the newly published French Srimad Bhagavatam. So he was very pleased to see that, of course. And when we went to New Mayapur in France, then the devotees arranged for this professor, François Chenic, to come and see Srila Prabhupada. Now, Professor Chenic had written a review of Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita Tel Quel A, yeah, French version of Bhagavad Gita as it is. And he had written a very nice, very favorable review of that. So now he'd just been shown this new volume of the Bhagavatam, so he was very excited about that. So he came to see Prabhupada. He was so nice, actually, that he was wearing a dhoti, and he had japa mala around his neck, and he had tilak on when he came in the room. He was actually on his way to a Buddhist convention, so he didn't really kind of regard himself as a devotee. But out of respect, you know, for the devotees, then he dressed like one. So he was very nice. Prabhupada liked him a lot. And so there was some preliminary introduction. Then Professor Shanik said that he was keen to see Srila Prabhupada's Srimad Bhagavatam come into use. There's only one other French translation of it, which had been done in the 1800s, and that has no commentary. Yet, at the university level, he said, the French are meticulous about maintaining the grammatical standards of their language. He was politely concerned that our translation should not smell of English, as he put it. Because we all know about the French paranoia about English, you know, invading their language. They even made a law against it. So he was expressing this same concern. He felt that since our books are translated from the English, the French literary expression is not always exactly correct, describing French as a more compact language than English. He wondered whether it might not be better to translate directly from the Sanskrit into French. Prabhupada was not very concerned, while acknowledging that if possible, improvements could be made to future editions. He explained that as yet, no French devotee had become a Sanskritist. But beside that, he said, it's not a question of scholarship. The translator must be a realized soul. He said that although there are many Sanskrit scholars in India, they cannot understand the Srimad Bhagavatam. He must be French, expert in language, at the same time a devotee, Prabhupada said. Then he can explain, otherwise no. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's secretary, Swarup Damodar, he asked that Bhagavat Padagya Bhagavat Stani, you go and study the Bhagavat from the Bhagavat. So I've discussed this in the beginning of translation of my Bhagavat. So the Bhagavat, that is the limit of education. Vidya Bhagavata Vidhi. One has to study and take education up to the Bhagavatam. That is, if one understands this Bhagavatam, then he has finished his education. The professor assured Srila Prabhupada that he wasn't in any way criticizing, but he was concerned that Prabhupada got the widest possible audience. He felt that an improvement in the way the French editions were written would ensure that. Prabhupada appreciated his concern, but he continued to stress his point. That is from the scholarship point of view, he said, but our point is that this Bhagavat must be presented by a Bhagavat, and there is not much scholarship required. Just like the Bhagavat begins with the words Jamadhyasya Jata. So this Sanskrit word means that the absolute truth is that from where everything emanates. Now, that absolute truth is further explained, Anvayadi Taratascha Abhigyasvarat. The absolute truth is aware of everything, directly and indirectly, of all of this creation. So in this way, if you step by step study, it is not a very difficult thing so far the word meanings are concerned. But it is a question of realization. Unless one is realized, he cannot explain properly. And that is the secret. Therefore, we have given the life of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in our Bhagavatam, because he is the living Bhagavatam. So Prabhupada referred then to Lord Chaitanya as the living Bhagavatam. And in the introduction, before he started his translation work of the Bhagavatam, he gave the life of Lord Chaitanya, because he is the example of the perfectly Krishna conscious person. And he exemplifies what the Bhagavatam is all about. It's not an intellectual study. It's a very practical thing that you have to transform your life and become fully Krishna conscious, fully God conscious, while you have this opportunity with the human form. So, as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was the living Bhagavatam, Srila Prabhupada was also a living Bhagavatam. He was Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's representative. And, you know, in the history of Vaishnavism, actually, nobody's done what Prabhupada did in spreading Krishna consciousness around the world to such effect as he did. So, because Prabhupada said that's the blessings of the previous acharyas. But still, you know, Prabhupada was an exceptional personality. So we, you know, we have this unique opportunity to learn from the Bhagwat, the person Bhagwat. We can see what it means to be a fully Krishna conscious person. So that's, anyway, that's my little introduction to this seminar, Prabhupada, the Living Bhagavatam, Pure Devotional Service by Example. Now I've got, as I mentioned, different topics. Normally what I do is I, you know, give the devotees the chance to choose the topic that they'd like to hear about, but I'm not going to do that tonight. I thought that it would be nice, because we have, you know, chanting, prasadam, books, health, so many different topics, but I thought that it would be nice to talk about deities, because as soon as Prabhupada had the opportunity, when he came to the West, he started opening temples, and he introduced us to worship of the deity, which is a totally foreign concept, you know, to practically every other religion in the world except Hinduism. Nobody understands what deities are or, you know, who they are. They think they're idols or, you know, something like that. But Prabhupada immediately, right from the very beginning, introduced us to deity worship. And there was a very specific reason for that. We just mentioned about the Bhagavatam. Of course, that provides us with the philosophy, Bhagavat Dharma. So that's one aspect. But then, on the practical side, there's another aspect which is centered around, you know, doing practical service for the Lord. And because God is everywhere, God is everything, as he just mentions there from the Bhagavatam, then how do you practically serve God? So the deity, the presence of the deity gives us that opportunity, how to do some personal service to the Supreme Lord. He appears in this deity form. And Prabhupada, therefore, wanted us, you know, to be introduced as that as soon as possible. In 1967, then, he immediately, when Lord Jagannath made his appearance in San Francisco, Prabhupada immediately engaged the devotees in making, you know, big Jagannath deities and then having this Rathayatra, which, you know, we've got coming up in 2 weeks' time. So, that was Prabhupada's program immediately. So the deity worship is very important. And during the time I was traveling with Prabhupada, he mentioned, of course, this many times. So I pulled out a few references and practical examples. So I thought it'd be nice if we start talking about the deities. And as you'll see, there's a very strong motivation for dealing with this topic here in London in front of Sri Sri Radhalandaneshwara. So anyway, I'll start with this. If anybody has any questions as we're going along, feel free to interrupt and I'll try to answer them. Does anybody have any questions up to this point? No? We're all happy? Okay, how long have we got actually?
Till 7.
Till 7, half an hour, okay. All right, so tonight's session till 7. Tomorrow when?
Same.
What about the morning?
Oh, the morning. 7:30 to 8:30.
All right, tomorrow morning, 7:30 to 8:30. Tomorrow evening, 5:30 to 7. And then again?
Thursday morning.
What about this? When are you having Nirjalakadasi?
Tomorrow.
So is that... It says there's a bhajan going on from 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah, sorry, that's a little bit. You're still giving classes.
Okay, don't be confused by the misinformation that's on the information board. You fix that up tonight, please. We will be having a session at Prabhupada the Living Bhagavatam tomorrow evening. There will be bhajans, but this is bhajan also. Another kind. So we will be talking tomorrow, and then again the next day, the same thing, morning and evening. So you're all invited to attend as much as you can. All right, so we're going to talk about deities today. So on March the 12th, 1976, Prabhupada was in Mayapur, We'd been there nearly 2 months at that point. Srisri Radha London Ishwara Kijan. Prabhupada had gone there for the Gaupunima festival. So during this class, Prabhupada explained to the hundreds of eager followers the benefits of deity worship. So by this time, there was about 500 devotees that had come to Mayapur for the Gaupunima festival. Prabhupada compared it to the process of yogic meditation by which one tries to see the Lord within the heart. He said, you may practice this hatha yoga or gymnastic yoga for many, many births. You cannot see Krishna. Krishna can be seen when you smear with love ointment on your eyes, and that is possible through bhakti. Therefore, why not practice bhakti yoga from the very beginning if you want to see Krishna? Krishna says, he is a first-class yogi who is always trying to see Krishna within his heart. So, is it a very difficult task? In our bhakti yoga, we teach this art of seeing Krishna within the core of the heart in 1 minute. It is so simple. You are seeing Krishna here. You must have impression. So you try to keep that impression within your heart always. And then you become a first-class yogi. So why so much gymnastic and pressing the nose? No, you take directly. If you're engaged 24 hours in the service of the deity, then you cannot see anything except the deity. This bhakti yoga is practical and so simple. Therefore, the Kanista Adhikari, those who are neophytes, they must take to the deity worship. Deity worship, he is elevated to the position of seeing the Lord within the heart. So this is a very important thing. You can see he is here, but you have no knowledge, or even if you have some knowledge, you are not competent to see him. But if you practice deity worship, then. So therefore it is the duty of the guru to engage the neophyte devotee always in deity worship. So you become, immediately, you see, just look at the deities on the altar, and immediately if you get that impression, you appreciate, here is Krishna. You're a yogi, straight away. All the hundreds of years that the mystic yogis, you know, they go through the whole Ashtanga yoga practice to get to the state of samadhi, just so they can see the Lord within the heart. But you can do that immediately. As Prabhupada said, 1 minute, that's it. The Lord is there, and if you appreciate, then you're in samadhi. Because you have to maintain that. That takes practice. But at least, you know, you get that chance right from the very beginning. So again, the importance of seeing the deity. Prabhupada stressed this in Mayapur again, February the 23rd. During his class, Prabhupada described the important role the temple plays in helping people to advance in spiritual life by agyata sukriti, or unknown pious activity. Sukriti means the way by which one can approach the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That is called sukriti, and agyata sukriti. So this temple means to give people the chance in general for this agyata sukriti, unknowing advancement. Anyone who will come to this temple where the deity is there, and even if by imitating others, if one offers obeisances to the Lord, that is taken into account. That is not useless, because this is Krishna's desire. He gives these four principles: that always think of me and become my devotee, worship me and offer obeisances to me. So these four principles will deliver you from the bondage of material existence. And without any doubt, Krishna says, you will come back to me. So you just come to the temple, bow down, you know, take a little prasadam, guaranteed advancement in spiritual life. Very simple. That's what we need. We're not big philosophers. We're Kali Yuga products. So we need some easier method than, you know, sitting in a cave in the Himalayas and, you know, doing pranayama and all these different things. Because it's interesting, Prabhupada makes that point there about yoga. Because nowadays, yoga has become a very big thing. Yeah. In Sydney, I was just there 2 weeks ago. Our devotees, they put on what's called the Yoga Expo. And we hire this very big hall. It's not a hall, actually. It was a former dock pier on the old docks, which has been turned now into, you know, like a very modern shopping centre, etc., in the middle of Sydney. So there's this place called Pier 8. You can hire it. So they hired this huge place, and then 100 booths. They sold them to all the different yoga groups, and they all gather there, and then, you know, they advertise this yoga expo. And we're there, of course, and we do catering and like that. And there's so many different kinds of yoga that are going on. Thousands of people come. They all pay like $15 or $20 to get in, and maybe 10,000 people in the weekend. They all attend this yoga expo. So there's a lot of interest in that kind of thing. And we've actually in Sydney, they've just bought a 25-acre property in the south of Sydney, and it was formerly a convention center for the Uniting Church. They used to have all their youth meetings and things there. So it's kind of set up like motel style with one very big building and, you know, fabulous facilities for kitchen and cafeteria and big hall like that. So they bought that, and this year's the first year of operation. They've been renting it out. It's called Govinda Valley. They've been renting that out as a place for, you know, yoga conventions. And they've had at least 30 weekends so far that have been booked out, $7,000 to $10,000 a weekend. And next year it'll increase. So, you know, there's this interest is there. So many yoga groups and different kinds of yoga, this yoga, that yoga. But Prabhupada's saying, actually, this is really yoga. If you don't see the Lord, if you don't actually get to the point of, you know, realizing God, then you know, all your yoga is useless. Yeah, pressing your nose and twisting your body this way and that way. That's not yoga. That's the preparation for yoga. Yoga is the linking up, yeah, where you identify yourself with the Supreme Lord. When that identification takes place, that's yoga. And all the other stuff is just, you know, some mechanical preparation for it. Anyway, so we have that chance. Back to yoga. We link up with Krishna. So again, April the 3rd, 1976, Prabhupada was in Vrindavan. We'd left Mayapur. We went to the Vrindavan site. And every morning, Srila Prabhupada displays great devotion and love, affectionately looking upon the deity's divine forms at darshan time. He stands surrounded by his devotees as the Govinda prayers boom over the sound system. The curtains open and he looks intently for a few seconds. Then he gets down and fully prostrates himself in obeisance to their lordships, Sri Sri Gaur-Nitai. Then he pushes himself back up to his knees, again touches his head to the floor, and then stands erect. Then he repeats this procedure at the altar of Krishna and Balaram, and then finally again before Sri Sri Radha Shama Sunda, who must be the most beautiful deities in all of Vrindavan. After sipping a little Charanamrita, he turns to walk back across the temple room floor to the Vyasasam. As he crosses in front of each altar, he does a clockwise 360-degree pirouette. So it's like a circumambulation on the spot. So when Prabhupada would walk back across in front of the altars, he would turn around full 360 degrees and go up to the Vyasasam. So in this class on April the 3rd, Prabhupada vividly explained why we worship the deities and how the same mood of devotion should be applied to everything that we do. He recalled a recent challenge by a man in Delhi. The man had asked that if God is everywhere, then what is the use of going to a temple? Prabhupada reversed the logic. If God is everywhere, then why not go to the temple? Yeah, he's certainly there also. He told us that it is like electricity. Electrical energy is everywhere, but wiring and the switch enable us to utilize it. Similarly, he said, Krishna is everywhere, and you can worship Krishna from anything. Everybody knows that the deity is made of stone. And this floor, marble stone, is black and white. The deity is also black and white. So everybody knows. But why do you see the black and white deity in this temple and gather together and offer prayers? Is it the same marble of the ground, black and white? That means that you are seeing in a different position. So that is love, love of Krishna. Those who haven't got that love, they are seeing, oh, the same stone on the floor, same stone in the deity. What are these foolish men worshipping? They say that, oh, I can worship this stone also. No. Krishna says, yes, the stone on the floor, that I am, but I am not present there. This is called a Achintya Bheda Bheda. They think that if Krishna has spread himself in everything, then he has lost himself. There is no more form. Yeah, Mayavadis. So this is a material calculation. These foolish persons, they do not know. I've several times given you the example that you take a big piece of paper and make it small pieces and you throw it into the air. So the big sheet of paper is no longer existing. It is finished. So their calculation is like that if Krishna is all pervasive, then where is his form? His form is finished. But that is nonsense. This is Krishna. Mayata tamidam sarvam. I am spread everywhere, all pervasive, but in my person I am not there. But a devotee should understand that Krishna is on the throne and Krishna is on the floor. So he's just said exactly the opposite to what he just said. As a devotee, we have to see that Krishna is actually everywhere. Therefore, we should be very careful to take care of the floor, to take care of the throne, to take care of the flower, to take care of the dishes. Everything you should worship like Krishna. You cannot neglect anything. Sri Vigrahara Dhananichanana Sringaratan Mandiramajanado. Everything is one. Everything is one. You cannot say Krishna is here sitting, I can neglect the floor. This is foolishness. You should take as much care to worship the deity, to decorate the deity, as to keep the temple very, very clean. That is Krishna consciousness. You cannot say that, oh, this person is working in the garden, therefore he is inferior. Oh, I am working directly on the Krishna altar. No, the person who is working in the garden is Krishna's garden. So he should be as careful as the person who is worshipping the deity in the temple. This is wanted. He concluded by saying that we should be very careful to keep this understanding. Just like the devotee who takes the dust of Vrindavan on his head. This is the proper mood, he said, because Vrindavan dust is Krishna. If we remember that every atom is Krishna, then our Krishna consciousness will be very, very strong and firmly established. Likewise, the great sky, that is also Krishna. So Krishna can be everywhere in his all-pervasive form, or he can appear in the very small form of the deity just to accept our service. Of course, this is the vision of the very advanced devotees, he told us, and we should not imitate, but this is the ideal platform to aim for. So that's real Krishna consciousness. I remember one time Prabhupada was in Vrindavan, and there was a devotee, British devotee, Charanaravindam, and Prabhupada had just arrived, and I think the temple actually was still under construction at that time. But Prabhupada's quarters had been finished. So he was in there, he gave a darshan. And this devotee, Charanaravindam, was in the darshan. And Prabhupada was complaining that everything was dirty. Nothing had been cleaned. He said, it's all, you know, covered with dirt and dust. And then Charanaravindam, he said, but, oh, Prabhupada, it's Vrindavan dust. So Prabhupada said, you may see it as Vrindavan dust, I see it as being dirty, clean it. So, you know, you can have that sentiment because that's, you know, foolishness. Oh, everything's Krishna, it's all Vrindavan dust. So you make, everything can become covered with dust, it doesn't matter. That's also, that's a neophyte understanding. But Prabhupada was training us up. So, anyway, Vrindavan, there were a lot of things Prabhupada said about the deities in Vrindavan. On November 25th, 1976, we were in Vrindavan, and Prabhupada made some nice comments about Lord Balaram. Prabhupada told us that we should be careful not to make friendship with our restless minds. Rather, it should be beaten with shoes and a broomstick and kept under control. Or we can take the alternative, kevala bhaktya, allowing Krishna to do it. Prabhupada brought to our attention the wonderful facility that he has provided for achieving this. If you can engage your mind at the lotus feet of Krishna, then it is possible. It means to keep your mind under control. Savai mana Krishna padara vindaya. Then Krishna will control. Krishna means light. Darkness, you are suffering in the darkness. So somehow or another, if you bring a light, then there's no darkness. Krishna Surya Sama Maya Haya Andaka Yahan Krishna Tahan Nahi Maya Adhika. So keep always within your mind Krishna, Krishna's lotus feet. You can see Krishna's lotus feet, the deity, Baladev, Balaram, how he is nicely standing. You can see the nice lotus feet. So don't try to see the face all of a sudden, but you try practically to see the lotus feet constantly. This is a chance. This temple means to practice how to think of Krishna's lotus feet, Balaram's lotus feet, always. Manmana bhavamad bhakta. Immediately you can become a bhakta. And as soon as you become a bhakta, kechit kevalaya bhaktya vasudeva parayana dunvanti agam krishnam. All kinds of disturbances will subside. Dunvanti. Niharameva bhaskara. So this is the shastric injunction. So he's talking about controlling the mind. So he's saying, this is practical. Meditate on the deity, and immediately your mind is controlled. And just keep that vision, Krishna's or Balaram's lotus feet within your mind every day, and your mind is automatically brought under control. Otherwise, very difficult. And that opening quote there about the broomstick and shoes, that was Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. He said that in the morning when you get up, you should beat your mind 100 times with shoes. And in the evening when you go to take rest, you should beat your mind 100 times with a broomstick. In other words, the mind is very difficult, very tricky thing. And it's always wandering off here and there, getting distracted, and, you know, dragging us away to things which are not important for us, for our progress in spiritual life. So control of the mind is emphasized in Bhagavad Gita by Krishna also. And Arjuna says, but it's really difficult. Yeah, like a raging wind, you put your hands up trying to stop the wind. What chance have you got? That's about as much chance as you've got for controlling your mind. But Krishna says, no, it can be done. But this is the way you fix the mind on an eternal principle. Naturally, the mind is disturbed and wanders because as long as it's fixed on material things, those things are not permanent. You know, they evaporate, they flicker and change at every moment. So that means the mind is always flickering and changing at every moment. But if you fix your mind on something eternal, then all that other stuff disappears. It becomes unimportant. You can endure it without being disturbed. So, anyway, that's Prabhupada's principle. You can understand why Prabhupada introduced deity worship as soon as it was possible, because he knew the importance. This is a very, very practical way to engage devotees in, you know, devotional service and keep them fixed up. And when we were in Hawaii in May of 1976, on the 17th, we were talking, and Prabhupada brought up this topic about deity worship. He told me that his god brothers and every sannyasi in India is criticizing him for giving Brahmin and sannyasi initiation and for installing deities in the West, and what to speak of about allowing women to live in the temples. But for all of that, he said, I am expanding, and for all of their strictness, they are doing nothing. He said, if I had been as discriminating as the others, then I would be alone as before in Vrindavan, and again I would become a mouse. So Prabhupada knew this principle. He did what he did because this was actually the best process for spreading Krishna consciousness. And if it had been very strict, as these others, you know, who were criticizing, liked to think they were, then he said, I would have nothing. and there'll be no temples and there'll be no devotees. So what's the point? You can criticize, but let's see practically. I'm not getting any juice from this power thing. My battery's about to conk out. Is it on?
Yeah.
What's happening there? We're going to come to an early end unless we get this working. Well, the light's on.
And this plug is beautiful. Does it come on when you wait a minute?
No. Maybe this thing here is not working or what? All right, we may make it. We've got 11% left, so let's see what happens. Okay, so now let's talk a little bit about the original deities that inspired Srila Prabhupada. I was very fortunate, actually, to go and visit these deities last year in Calcutta. Prabhupada mentions quite a few times about how he was inspired by Sri Sri Radha Govinda when he was brought up in what was then at the time Harrison Road in Calcutta, a very important road. There was this Mandir, Radha Govinda Mandir, and those deities were worshipped by Prabhupada's relatives. And Prabhupada actually used to live opposite that temple with his parents, and every day they would go for darshan and see Sri Sri Radha Govinda. And so on March the 23rd, 1976, after Prabhupada had just spent 2 months in Mayapur, we went back to Calcutta, and in the evening, Prabhupada decided to go to the Mullock's house on Harrison Road, which is now Jatindra Mohan Avenue, in the area where he used to live as a child. He was greeted enthusiastically by Kasinath Mullock, along with other Mullock family members and friends. Prabhupada was very, very happy to see Sri Sri Radha Govinda, the original deities who had provided his spiritual inspiration as a small child. Although the area has changed considerably from his childhood days, and the little courtyard and shrine are quite run down, the deities are still obviously well looked after and offered daily puja. The Mullocks and other friends were delighted to see Srila Prabhupada, although Prabhupada told us that most of his contemporary friends were now dead. Only one or two of those present were actually the people that he had played with during his childhood. He told us that the deities had been worshipped by the Mullocks for over 200 years. At one time, the deities owned the entire area, so all the buildings and everything was all property of the deities. Even now, the government building just across the street is the property of Sri Sri Radha Govinda. In a short speech, Prabhupada recalled his childhood history. His family, he said, had lived just down the street behind a building called Govinda Bhavan. And as a 3 or 4 year old, he would come every day to see the deities. And that is the inspiration of my devotional life, he told us. Then I asked my father that give me this Radha Govinda deity, and I shall worship. So my father, he was also a Vaishnav, so he gave me a small Radha Govinda deity, and I was worshipping in my house. Whatever I was eating, I was offering, and I was following the ceremonies of this Radha Govinda with my small deity. So that deity is still existing. I have given them to my sister. And Prabhupada's own personal deities he gave to his sister later on. So then I introduced this Rathayatra. So my Rathayatra was being performed very gloriously. My father used to spend the money. In those days, 10 rupees, 20 rupees was sufficient. And I hired one kirtan party and all my small friends, and there was another day family here. So we all performed this Rathayatra ceremony. So according to our child's imagination, it was very gorgeous. So Gopishvara Mullock was my father's friend. So he was criticizing my father that, oh, you were performing the Rathayatra ceremony and you were not inviting us. So my father said, oh, it's simply child's play. What shall I invite you? You're a very big man. Oh, so you are avoiding, in the name of children, you are avoiding us. So on the whole, this Rathayatra festival was very gorgeously performed. And then imitating me, the others, my brother, he also introduced Rathiatra. And all of them introduced Rathiatra. And the destination was this Thakur Bari from there. Thakur Bari means the house of the Thakur, or deity, the house of the Lord. So practically, what I am doing now, means in ISKCON, the same thing. Radha Krishna worship and introduction of Rathiatra. I'm not doing anything else. You know very well, we are now performing Rathiatra ceremony practically in all big cities of the world. In San Francisco, Philadelphia, London, Melbourne, Paris. So the same thing. The same Radha Krishna worship, the same Rathiatra, but on a bigger scale. But the same thing was begun as a play from this quarter at this Thakur Bari. So this Thakur Bari, Radha Govindaji, is my life. That is the beginning of my spiritual life. And after so many years, still Radha Govindaji has dragged me here. It is his kindness. Prabhupada humbly suggested that his good fortune was due to his previous activities. He quoted Bhagavad Gita 6:41, which states that the unsuccessful yogi takes birth in the family of pious and prosperous persons. The Day family, he said, was practically the same as the wealthy Mullicks, and his own father was a pure Vaishnav. So with these opportunities provided by his birth, he said, he was simply developing them on a wider scale by Krishna's arrangement. Looking lovingly at Sri Sri Radha Govinda, he ended his little speech. So about this movement, it may be said, this Radha Govinda deity is the inspiration. You are all fortunate that you have come here. So let us offer our obeisances. Prabhupada humbly bowed down, touching his head to the floor. And, amid much affection from his old friends, he climbed back in the car to return to his own recently established Radha Govinda Mandir. So, now you know why Prabhupada called the deities in his temple at Albert Road in Calcutta Radha Govinda, same, because it's the same deity. Not the same deity, but the same person. So he gave him the same name. And as I mentioned, last year I actually went there, and I saw, we went about 6 o'clock in the morning, and the pujari was there, and he was dressing Radha Govinda. He just finished bathing him, and very nice, simple worship, but very nice, going on after 250 years, still going on. So this is the advantage, at least in India. So let's hope that we're also in 250 years time, they're still bathing and dressing Radha Londoneshwara here in London. Yes, Prabhu. They're not big. They're brass deities, about 18 inches. 18, 20 inches. I actually managed to get 2 photos before they stopped me. In India, they don't like you taking photos of the deities, but my daughter was there and she just whipped out the camera. Took a couple of shots whilst they were bathing them, so we got a couple of nice shots. Beautiful, nice deities they are. And they also, they have Krishna Balaram there as well on another altar. So, any other questions up to this point? Alright, we may just make it. We've only got 3 minutes and we've got 7% battery jump. So. Okay, so again, Prabhupada talked about these deities, Radha Govinda. We were in Tehran, in Iran. This was in early August, August the 12th, 1976. In those days, you could still go into Iran, of course. The Shah of Iran was in charge, and we had a temple there. There were 3 or 4 householder couples and 1 sannyasi, and they were doing the preaching there. They had no deities, which some of the devotees were kind of lamenting. But, you know, of course in Iran, it's a little difficult to install deities. The Muslim faith, they regard it as a big offense. In fact, the biggest offense to ascribe personality to God. They're full-on Mayavadis. Yeah? You can't talk about God as a person. They consider that to be offensive. Anyway, so there were no deities there in Tehran, in our temple. But we'd been talking about that, and then Prabhupada brought the subject to Radha Govinda in Calcutta. So I asked Prabhupada who the people were who had gathered to see him when we had visited his childhood deities, Sri Sri Radha Govinda, in Calcutta at the beginning of this year. Oh, they're just like my younger brothers, Prabhupada said. Their elder brothers were my contemporary, but they're all died. So these were all younger. They are all my childhood playmates. The elder brothers, the eldest was my very, very intimate friend, Siddhaswar Mulloch. So we used to ride in the same pram when we were 3 or 4 years old. The Rathiata Sarani was performed with all of these guests. So they were about, in our neighborhood, 4 or 5 houses. So all the children of the same age, and I was the leader. And I organized this Rathiatra. I was performing Radhastami and Janmastami, and I was learning how to dress Radha Govinda. Oh, you used to go in and dress them, I asked. So it was our house, Prabhupada affirmed, just 3 or 4 houses afterwards. So Radha Govinda were the only deities in the neighborhood, I asked. Only deities, yes. Sri Sri Radha Landanishwara Ki Jai. Shall I finish this? Yeah, okay. And Radha Govinda has big property. In front of the deity house, there is a very big building. So just opposite, that is his building. Very good income. Besides that, he has many other lands, and they have a very good income from that. I observed that they appear to be well looked after. Prabhupada agreed and said the Mulloks were one of the oldest aristocratic families of Calcutta. The whole, from Howrah Bridge up until that street, everything belonged to their property. They were very rich men. So he explained that the deity gets so much income from properties, and the various Mulloch families have a certain term each for worshipping the deities. Whosoever term it is, then they get that income. So the money's coming in, and then, of course, you know, many generations, then you get many branches. So they take it in terms by family, who's going to look after the deity for a certain period of time. So during that period of time, whenever income is coming in, that goes to that family, and they use that for worshipping the deity and, of course, for maintaining themselves. So Prabhupada laughed. He said, practically now, that is their income. The more that one gets the worshipping term for longer, so he gets more income. So the deity has got very, very good income. And he said, all the temples in India, just like I am trying to make some fund for Vrindavan and Mayapur. So then even if no contribution comes in, then everything will go on. So the Seva Puja will not stop for want of money. So there'll be no want of money. Still, I must make some provision by the income that Seva Puja will go on. So contribution may come or not, that provision should be made. Now in Vrindavan, Akshayananda is collecting in so many ways, but suppose nobody collects. So that does not mean that this temple should be closed. It must go on. So I'm trying to make some provision from that bank interest, at least 5-10,000 rupees a month, so that the deity worship will not be stopped. That is the system in all Indian temples, that it must go on. Nitya Seva. These big, big temples in Vrindavan, they have all got such arrangements. Otherwise, how it is going on for 500 or 600 years? They have very good income. Govindaji has got at least 18,000 rupees monthly income. He is the richest deity in Vrindavan. And Ranganath is a tenant of Govindaji. Yeah, there's a Ranganath temple. Lord Ranganath lives in that temple. But he's actually a tenant of Govindaji. One deity is the tenant of the other one. Land is taken from Govindaji and Ranganath's temple is constructed. So the Ranganath temple management, they pay that rent. So Govindaji is the landlord and Ranganath, he is the tenant. He laughed. Ranganathji, he is Ramanuja Sampradaya. So Govindaji, he is the Gaudiya Sampradaya. So the Ramanuja Sampradaya is the tenant of the Gaudiya Sampradaya. So that's nice. And that fund that Prabhupada's referring to there is the MVT fund. Those of you that have been to Vrindavan in the last few years, you'll see behind our temple, we have this nice arrangement called the MVT. That's the Mayapur Vrindavan Trust. And whatever money was given to Srila Prabhupada as Guru Dakshin, as gifts, then he immediately would put that into this Mayapur Vrindavan Trust Fund. And then he was using that as a discretionary fund. in the 70s when we were just starting up in India. We didn't have a lot of income, so Prabhupada was giving loans and donations from that Mayapur Vrindavan Trust Fund. But the intention of that trust fund was that the deities in Vrindavan or Mayapur, they should not be without, you know, proper funding. He said, of course, there's no likelihood, actually, that there will not be sufficient funds, but still you should make the provision, just in case, you never know. So he said, then that from that you put the money in a fixed deposit, and then every month you get some interest. And that interest you use for the deity worship to guarantee it. So that's the system. And he made a system like that in Los Angeles. Prabhupada used this Mayapur Vrindavan Trust Fund money to buy 3 apartment blocks. Then the devotees live in those apartment blocks. They pay the rent, and that money comes to the Mayapur Vrindavan Trust. Or at least it's supposed to. Nowadays it goes to the LA Temple. That's an ongoing dispute at the moment. But anyway, that's the principle. So that example Prabhupada's using there from Radha Govinda, his original deities. So do we stop now, or what is that? Yes, we have to stop now. If anybody has any questions or comments, you can see myself later on. Maybe not this evening. I'm a little spaced out at the moment. Bit of jet lag, but tomorrow I'll be here, next 3 days. And if anybody's interested, all of the things that I've been reading from, they're all in this book, Transcendental Diary. There are 5 volumes. You have those here? Alright, we have a stock here. We didn't get them out this evening, but this is the 5th volume. This just came out just last year. And as I said, there'll be 2 more volumes. So if you're interested to read about Srila Prabhupada, enter into his transcendental pastimes, then you can get a copy of all 5 copies of Transcendental Diary. And I'm not just because I wrote it, but I'm quite confident that, you know, you'll become very enlivened from getting that intimate connection with Srila Prabhupada. So that's it for tonight, and we'll continue at 7:30, was it? Yeah, 7:30 tomorrow morning. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Jai. Jai.